If you stroll by the post office in Westport, you might notice a little patch of greenery nestled between the sidewalk and the stone building. Lush plants, a bird feeder, and a bountiful little herb garden. Lately, it's been very popular with butterflies, and they're not the only ones drawn to this tiny oasis. People have gotten attached to it too, as the post office recently discovered. See, the post office didn't do this landscaping. It's actually the handiwork of a woman who lives in the neighborhood. She's done this on her own for years, and when the post office moved to shut it down, people came out of the woodwork to object. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard, and we're going to hear the story of Glenn Stewart and the little piece of land she's been tending in Westport for the last 8 years. Hi, Glenn.
Hi, how are you?
Good, how are you?
I'm good, thanks.
Busy, it seems like. I mean, there's been a media frenzy around this.
Yeah, it's really heartwarming.
Let's start from the beginning. What inspired you to begin tending this little space between the post office and the sidewalk, a spot that, I mean, it's such a small plot of land that a lot of people might not even have noticed it was there.
That's true. It started about 8.5 years ago, and I've always loved a garden. I grew up in the South. I'm very, very attached to that, and I've always had a, quote, quote, green thumb, and I live in an apartment building, and so I didn't have access to gardening, but I had a P.O. box there, and one day I went by and looked at the roses and that mud patch. And I thought, oh, I could take care of those roses. So I asked the manager, and he said, sure. And then I got the idea to just put a little bed in. And so I asked again, and he said, sure. Now, this is on the side that faces Mario's.
Yeah, and, right on Westport Road.
Yes, yes. And so, I did things like haul a railroad tie away and set up a little boundary. And what I liked about it was, you know, it's always a challenge. I consider it an art challenge to figure out if the soil's good, where to put something, where to put some little boundaries to kind of make it colorful and that kind of thing. So
I remember,
I
have to say, I remember what it was like before. I spent a lot of time in Westport, you know, about a decade ago, 2 decades ago. Mm-hmm. And that spot was a pretty popular place for Kansas City's homeless to congregate and hang out.
It was, and I'll tell you, until I really started putting bushes and grasses in and installed art on the wall so they couldn't sit on it, it was colorful. I was very good friends with two or three of the cops. They were called often if I was there. They really considered it their territory. And so, yeah, so I had several goals, was to create a situation people could enjoy, beautify it, but also help make it safe.
Have you heard from anyone in that community that used to hang out there since then?
Actually, I have. In fact, there was an interview maybe a couple of years ago with Midtown KC Post, and one of the guys that used to sit there happened to walk by and apologized for behaving that way and thanked me for, you know, creating that. I think he said, God bless you, and I said, bless you back.
You know, the neighborhood's overall attachment to the garden has become clear in the last several weeks, and a lot of that has to do with where you take the herbs you grow. Can you talk to me about that?
Yes, and I'd like to add, too, that after I started that side, about 4 years ago, I started wrapping around the larger side, which was more of a challenge. The herbs, well, I have a huge bed of lemon balm that people just walk by and grab the leaf and put it in their mouth and keep walking. I had apple mint, regular mint, several types of herbs, a huge Russian sage bush that, of course, is edible and medicinal. And so for, I'd say, the past 3 years, I've taken all of that to Californos every weekend for their drinks. And this is all, there's no money exchange. This is just, you know, making people happy. And then there's a shift of firemen that helped me haul some stuff. And they used to be over at the firehouse, which is now a coffee house over there on Washington. And so they loved to cook, and I would always take herbs on the weekend to them. Yeah.
What inspired you to, I mean, this is a pretty big time commitment from everything you're describing to care for this whole garden and also to take the fruits of your labor around the neighborhood. Where has this fit into your life?
Well, it's a kind of situation, since I'm kind of used to the routine about how to deal with gardening and that type of thing. I'd always just go by early in the morning before work, regardless of the time of year. There's birds to feed. I had a dove sanctuary. They're really goofy little animals that we could learn a lot from. And then, you know, in the afternoon after work, I would go by, and when the weather was decent, you know, I'd work and work on the weekends. And I had lots of support from the Heart of Westport when I began to get involved with them. And people would, you know, for example, the huge Russian sage plant is a donation from Benson Law Firm. There's just story after story of every plant or every piece of art. People would leave things. And so it was, you know, it was a good chunk of my life.
You know, we don't have a comment from the post office, but the post office has commented to a lot of media outlets over the course of this story. And one of the that large bush is one of the things that seems to be at issue. Their comment to KSHB 41 was that the garden was sort of overgrown. And then recently, more recently, they told KCTV 5 that you all had met and that an agreement had been made that was acceptable to everyone, and that since then nothing had changed for them. Can you talk about where this all stands right now?
Sure. First, I'd like to say something about the overgrown. You know, there's several types of landscaping. What I do is called au naturel, and that means rather than taking boxwood and sawing them off straight, you let some leaves show. So I understood what they were saying, and I offered to trim things back. Unfortunately, I was ordered off the property and not given the opportunity. When I did meet with the postal employees, upper bracket employees, the only thing they offered me was five holes where I could put herbs in after they took everything out, but I couldn't water it or attend to it. That doesn't really sound like saving the magic garden, does it to you?
Can you explain the name Magic Garden?
Oh, yes. It's sort of wired into my brain. I got the idea, I think, the first year I was doing this, because between the characters that hung out on the wall and, you know, trampled, and the challenge with erosion and soil, and you never know where the Russian sage is going to pop up the next year. Mother Nature just sort of told me every year where the boundaries were going to be. And all that being said, I thought it was magical that I was allowed to create it, that it survived the elements and the people and the environment.
You know, it takes a certain kind of personality to just walk by a spot, notice that there's a patch of mud, and offer to plant a garden at the post office without any kind of formal invitation, and then spend, it sounds like, multiple times a day working in that garden with no formal agreement for 8 years.
Mm-hmm. Well, yes, and actually it was on the Urban Farms and Garden Tour a couple of times, and the first year it was on, there was a student from UMKC. She was studying government, and she wrote a paper about it, and it's called An Edible Landscape. And it's basically the concept of putting something visually appealing that can also, quote, quote, feed people in between the concrete and the streets. And evidently, it's a very common, popular urban trend right now.
But do you think that, I don't know, there are so many community gardens right now, really like formal opportunities for people who don't have their own little plot of land to go and garden somewhere. And I'm interested in your approach, which is to see a spot that it seems like called for you to garden in it rather than seek out that opportunity where it's being provided.
I agree. And again, I think that's one of the reasons it's a trend. And I believe particularly in an urban core where you have less access to greenery and that kind of thing, it's very appealing. And in our stressful times right now, people are really drawn to that kind of thing. And so what I suggest is, if you see a space like that, first of all, find out if it's legally permissible. Number one. And number two, make sure you have a water source. and go for it.
Is that hard for you right now? Because part of that is the risk that someday the answer is not going to just be sure anymore, you know?
Well, honestly, Gina, right now I'm just sort of taking a rest. I was allowed 1 week after we met last week. I was allowed until yesterday to remove any install art, any of the greenery. So lots of people came and dug things up. The art, install art, and everything has been removed and, you know, given around and that kind of thing. And so I'm just going to exhale right now because I'm working on a short film and I still, you know, have a job. And so there are other slices of my life. And I'm just going to think about what I'm going to do next.
As someone who makes films, is there a similarity between the project you've taken on in Westport and the making of a short film?
You know, that's a very good question. And the kind of short films I make, they're short documentaries, and I don't really, other than getting some ideas about shots and, you know, where I want the person to sit and that kind of thing, I let the film and the person tell me how it's going to be. And I sort of do that with my gardening, too.
Is there a particular spot within the garden or a particular moment that you remember there that you think is going to really stick with you in a special way?
Yeah, the butterfly bush, I sort of created a sanctuary, and around it was some milkweed. And the bush, we counted, a bunch of us counted last week, 20 butterflies on the bush. Baby monarchs, grown-ups, several varieties. But a couple of years ago, this butterfly that none of us had ever seen appeared, and people were coming out of the post office to take pictures.
Glenn Stewart, thank you so much for telling your story. Next on the show, Carrie Hawkes grew up in Kansas City. Now a self-identified queer artist living in Brooklyn, Carrie's made a movie about a childhood search for Black identity. You can hear that story on KCUR Central Standard in just a minute. Stay tuned.
I spent a lot of time trying to get this. Irrefutable acceptance of my Blackness. But other people challenge me. Not because of my ancestry, because I break too many rules. Black bylaws.
That's artist Carrie Hawkes.
23!
You must like fried chicken and hot sauce. It's cool, guys. I still like watermelon.
81!
Quit talking white, girl.
You may not go to a ski lodge. Black people don't ski, Christy. I can't do this.
That's stupid. You're here and you're skiing, aren't you?
Yeah.
So they do. Shut up and go down the hill.
Okay.
Carrie has a new movie out. It's called Black Enough, with an asterisk.
And it's not just me looking for acceptance. My family, too.
Carrie's brother, Tim, puts his hands over his young daughter's ears as though he's about to say a bad word.
I think now maybe I feel more comfortable with white people, but, and I have guilt about that. I feel bad about it. There you go.
I'm Gina Kaufman, and today on KCUR Central Standard, we're talking to Carrie Hawkes about what it means to be Black enough. Carrie, good morning.
Good morning.
So, this idea of being on a quest for irrefutable acceptance of your Blackness. What does that mean? Why do you need acceptance, irrefutable acceptance?
Well, I think growing up, in particular because of the schools I went to and listening to different music, like not listening to hip hop, listening to Jimi Hendrix or like Landslide or Fleetwood Mac or things like that. Sometimes my Blackness got called into question. Like I was supposed to follow a certain way to be Black. Like there was one way to be Black. And if you did not do that thing, then your Black card got revoked. So I was constantly like trying to fit in that way, but also trying to be myself and follow things that spoke to me.
You're from Kansas City, and that's where this quest for belonging begins. You've mentioned the schools you went to. Tell me about your childhood.
So Yeah, I moved to Kansas City when I was about 4 years old. And then in sixth grade, I got a scholarship to go to a very privileged school, private school in Kansas City. But I was one of four black girls in my grade. So it was like a total night and day from, I came from a public school where there was like two white kids. And then I went to this very small private school where there was very few black people. And so it was just kind of like a big switch for me. And then my brothers were going there as well. And then, you know, as you're going through puberty and adolescence, you're trying to figure out who you are, you're trying to find your identity. And I had these things happening, like the class differences between me and my classmates, the racial differences, and just trying to figure all that out at that crucial time in my life.
These two different school settings and your different role as being sort of surrounded by other people who may have looked like you, and then having being just one of four black girls in an entire grade. Can you talk a little bit about how that felt different?
Well, I felt a little different when I was at public school, but I mean, everyone there was black, so it was never like a racial issue per se. Like, you know, sometimes like you have to wear these sneakers. These sneakers are in. If I don't have them, then oh no, I'm not in. And then when I came to the other school, it was just like sometimes you were incredibly visible but also invisible at the same time. Like people would call you by someone else's name and you're like, no, that's the other black girl. I'm Carrie, or things like that. And so you stuck out, but then at the same time you weren't a person.
You talked about in the movie Black Enough about being invited, I can't remember whether it was to homecoming or prom, but that was a kind of poignant story. Would you mind telling it?
Oh, yeah. So homecoming was coming up. That was probably like the first high school dance. That was the first high school dance that I would have gone to, I think. And there was a black guy in a lower grade than mine. And he basically kind of worked his way through most black girls at the school. And then eventually, like after like things didn't work out or people rebuffed him, then he asked me to go to homecoming. But then he got along well with his ex, so that didn't work out. So I was just kind of like, oh, well, OK, I guess I'm the last, second to last picked. And then I don't get the corsage after all.
You mentioned in the little clip that we played, it's the opening of your movie and also it was the way we opened the show. You mentioned black bylaws that you sort of, I don't know, defy. What was your earliest sense that you were defying some kind of spoken or unspoken rule about what it meant to be, quote unquote, black enough?
It's hard to pinpoint the earliest, but I do remember a lot of times people saying that I talked white. And I was like, well, this is how my mom talks and this is how we were raised talking. So this is just how I talk. And they're like, no, you talk white. And I'm like, no, like I talk like my parents. My parents aren't white, so therefore I can't talk white. So I think that having that early conversation was like, oh, something's off here about me.
There's some details in the movie also about maybe like how you dressed or the music you listened to. You've already touched on music, but can you talk a little bit about how, like, personal expression of through appearance?
Yeah, so I definitely had a goth phase, which I still feel like I'm a goth inside always.
But
I wore a lot of black. I wore inside always, yeah. Well, when I first started wearing colors in college, my friends like, Carrie, you'll always be a goth. And I'm like, yeah, you're right. But I wore a lot of black. Like, I got these amazing combat boots with steel-toed shoes at the Salvation Army. I had a collar at one point with spikes on it, like black fingernail polish.
And this is the 90s, so that was kind of a look.
Yeah, it was definitely a look. Not necessarily always popular, but definitely a look.
The one sentence promotional description on the website for your movie says, a queer oddball seeks approval from black peers, despite a serious lack of hip hop credentials and a family that talks white. Can I ask you, first of all, a queer oddball, is that how you see yourself?
Yeah, especially growing up, like I've come to New York now and there's oddballs everywhere. So it's like, you're not always necessarily the weirdest person there. And I'm definitely not the weirdest person here. But growing up there, I just felt like there weren't a lot of people like that around. Like, I'd go to a goth event, there wouldn't be a lot of black people around. I was still in the closet at that point, so I didn't know if there were queer people around. So I just felt alone a lot of the times, and this was also before the internet. So I didn't know that there were other people out there like me. I didn't know about things like Afropunk, so I just thought, like, oh man, I'm just totally off here, and nobody's gonna be like me ever.
How did you deal with that?
Not well. I'd say I had depression for a lot of times when I was in middle school and high school. And I can be extremely shy or I can be extremely outgoing. So I just mostly went for the shyness, I think, in high school. And just kind of stuck to myself. I had some good friends and then we stuck together, but, I definitely didn't feel confident.
And what do you mean when you say you lack hip-hop credentials? Are hip-hop credentials, does that weigh heavily on you still, or is that sort of a childhood thing?
Not so much anymore. Like, I've come into my own a lot now, but I remember getting teased for not having the new Warren G album. Like, I had the single, but I wasn't listening to the entire album, whereas I was really into Marilyn Manson or Nine Inch Nails, and that did not fly with a lot of people who wanted me to be listening to one thing or the other. But when I came to New York and I went to Barnard, I went to the Barnard, like basically the black women group for students at Barnard. And I kind of admitted, like, oh, I like heavy metal. And then someone else in the group was like, oh, I like country. And then it was kind of this moment where, like, oh, we're allowed to like different things and we could still be black. And this is... It was like, I was nervous to say it in front of a group of people, but then it was like, oh, I'm not the only one. This is fantastic.
But this is, you know, a long time past that realization that you can like whatever music you like. And it's still something that you're working through enough that you needed or wanted to make this movie. And I want to understand that, like, what is the evolution of how you address these things for yourself and just larger, just on a societal scale?
Well, I started making some artwork about racial identity when I was in college and then a little bit after. I had like a small little comic, like just a couple panels called Yellow Number 5, where I was just dealing with issues of like not listening to the right music, not dressing the right way, not speaking the right way. And a lot of that was me pushing back on those ideas that I had to be a certain identity, even though I felt very awkward about it. And then eventually I moved to Atlanta where I was like, I'm just going to be surrounded by black people and then it won't be an issue. And even there, like, I feel a little bit nervousness, like, oh, when they find out that, you know, I like Fleetwood Mac or I do this certain thing, then they're not going to like me anymore and that it's over. And that didn't always happen. And then I started exploring more things about African diaspora and parts of the culture that I really did like. And so I felt like I was finding things that responded to me versus finding things that I was supposed to respond to. So that helped a lot. But making the film was kind of just a way to accept myself and to love myself more.
In the movie, you talk a lot about your family. And in fact, you interview members of your family, your mom, your dad, and your brother. And everyone shares kind of different attitudes toward blackness and black identity. Can you talk to me about that?
Yeah, well, my mom grew up in the segregated South, so she had a lot of things that she'd gone through where, like, I was feeling like you were separated, but she was, you know, she was on a segregated bus. She was in a segregated church, and when she got to college, it was like there was still segregation happening, so it was, like, literal. It was definitely not in her head, and it was not just a feeling. So for her, she was definitely always black. But then when she started working for the city, like, people would also tease her, like, oh, you talk white. And my mom grew up in Pensacola, Florida. Like, she's definitely not white. But she also was, like, dealing with issues of what this idea of there's one monolith that is black identity. And then my father had the direct opposite experience where he was, like, the only black family in his town. And his father actually passed for white at some times in order to buy property. And so he was giving, like, the extreme opposite where he was. Actually, he grew up in Michigan.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, but he did move to East St. Louis when he was surrounded by all black people. And for him, that was kind of a culture shock to be in all black people versus being the only one in majority white people.
I want to play a clip from Black Enough. What's happening on screen at the beginning is that we're seeing cassette tapes being labeled and relabeled, and we're hearing the sound of those tapes popping in and out of a tape player. You talk first with your mom and then with your dad. Let's listen.
I didn't live up to my mother's expectations either.
I wanted to make sure that you understood what the Black culture brought into the world.
I told you that my first tape was a Beach Boys tape that my dad had given me.
Hmm.
And you said, well, your dad's different.
TV was a big thing then, and all the TV shows, cowboys and westerns were big then. Indians were the bad guys. And I didn't want to identify with that. And I remember one time I came home and, you know, you scratch your skin and it turns light. So I just started scratching my arms so I could turn light and be just like the others. It's like having an oddity about you, a handicap or something about you.
That story from your dad is really heartbreaking, that he would scratch his skin to try and make himself more white.
Yeah. And it's funny because a lot of these stories I didn't know until I sat down and interviewed my family, and I was like, I'm going to make a film about this. And then they just started telling me things that I never knew, and we had conversations that we hadn't had before. Like, a lot of people assume if you're in a family, then you know all these things about this person, but honestly, you don't. So it was also very sad to hear that he had those feelings when he was a kid. And like, I don't know, my dad, like, I pair it with a picture of my dad when he's this cute little boy and he looks really happy, but you really don't know what's going on inside until you talk to a person.
So if your journey in search of belonging, you know, begins in Kansas City, what happens in that search when you leave home and start experiencing other places? Do you feel like you've discovered different attitudes toward race, different ways of moving through the world when you go to different places? You go to New York, Japan, and Atlanta.
Yeah, it was funny in Japan because at my school in Kansas City, it was one of very few. And then in Japan, it's like the majority of people are Japanese. So if you're white, you're a minority. And if you're Black, you're a special minority. And it was just, it was really weird to be walking down the street there because I taught English there and a lot of my students had never met a Black person in their life. So they had some ideas about what Blackness was. Like, I went to hip hop and they're like, oh, obviously, like, you were the best dancer. And I'm like, I'm a good dancer, but I don't necessarily know these hip hop moves. Like, they were like, you know, spinning and break dancing, and I can't do that at all. And then in New York, there was definitely more of a many different ways to be Black or to be anything. I feel like so many different kinds of people come here, and there's so many different ways of expression that you're not really as odd as you think you are. And then when I went to Atlanta, it was just like, oh, this Black Mecca, like there's Blackness everywhere, people doing poetry, people, you know, speaking differently, speaking bougie or whatever. And I just felt like, oh, okay, so here there's sky's the limit on what you can be.
Do you come back to Kansas City very much?
I do. I come back generally for Christmas every year. My best friend got married last summer, so I came back for that. And then here and there, usually it's once a year, sometimes twice a year.
I'm wondering if you feel like, I don't know, if you feel like your perspective on Kansas City and especially race on Kansas City has changed at all, either with becoming more and more of an outsider in this city, looking in, or just having that adult vantage point, or even if it's possible that things here have changed in some way.
It's hard to say how much they've changed because when I come back, it's just like for a very brief visit. But I do remember when I left and I went to Atlanta and I went to this art opening and I was like, wow, this place is so mixed because there was Black people, like, you know, five, and white people in the same room. I'm like, this is unheard of. And my friend in Atlanta was like, this is so segregated. And then I'd go back to Missouri and sometimes the racial prejudices were just like on the surface sometimes. Like I went to some bar in Brookside and like these patrons were giving the bouncer they were giving him a hard time, and a lot of it had to do with the fact that he was Black, and because they figured, well, he's Black, he's not a homeowner, he doesn't, you know, earn this type of money, and he was really frustrated and he had to work in that situation, you know, every weekend. And I was like, oh, yeah, that makes sense. But I mean, in other ways, when I go back, like there was a queer meeting for like social group of people hanging out, and there's like more art happening, there's more theater happening. So I don't exactly know what's always happening there, but it does seem better in some ways. But then in other ways, I'm like, yeah, that's why I left.
Paul tweets us, and this is kind of an extended series of tweets, but bear with me. Paul says, I'd love to know what Carrie thinks about finding ways to make minority identities more visible in Kansas City. I don't think I was comfortable in my skin until moving to Washington to go to college. The Midwest really prides normalcy and conformity. Paul continues to say, on the coast, you have more fluid identities that coexist with corporate and professional environments. Do you think that'll change in Kansas City? Ever?
Well, I guess I'm not the only one. I think it, you know, what helps change is like seeing yourself represented like in art and music and television and things like that. Seeing your stories be told, like in theater and music, just seeing yourself presented as a whole human being, not like, oh, okay, we need a black person, let's cast this black best friend, or let's cast this other person, like a more whole identity of yourself represented.
We're listening back to an interview I did in the summer with Carrie Hawkes, an artist who created a movie called Black Enough. At the time, no local screenings had been scheduled, but that's changed. Black Enough debuts in Kansas City this Friday at the Kemper Museum of Art. We have to take a quick break. I'm Gina Kaufman, and KCUR's Central Standard will be back in a minute. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard. Our guest, Carrie Hawkes, made a movie called Black Enough. It tells a story mostly set here in Kansas City about a search for an answer to the question of what it means to be black enough. When I spoke to Carrie, the movie was showing in New York and L.A., but now it's finally going to debut in Kansas City this Friday. Carrie, I'm intrigued by the call for stories you put out there to get other people's stories about what it means to be black enough. Did you get a big response?
I got some response online. I think it's hard to like type out a whole thing and share your story online. And then I went to Afropunk, which is a big music festival here, and I went with a friend, and he recorded people. I think we interviewed like 7 people, just asking them on the spot, like, what does it mean to be black enough? And I got some answers that surprised me.
Like what?
I walked up to this woman wearing a dashiki and natural hair, and she just joked like, oh, I don't feel black enough. And I was like, you don't? Like, well, if you don't, well, then I don't know where I am. And then another young person, they gave a really warming answer, which basically they said that to be black enough means to mean that you have to love yourself more, because you're going to get a lot of pressures and like negativity. So you have to always love yourself more. So those were 2 surprising answers that I got.
There's a story you tell in the movie about a time when one of your friends, a black friend actually, teases you about your feet. Let's give that a listen.
I knew it. Now I got proof.
Well, what are you talking about?
Your feet are so pale, they're paler than Jamie's. And she's a redhead.
So?
So you're not black. You're just a white person who got a tan and forgot to take her shoes off.
Jamaica always teases me. But today, I can't take it.
So who decides whether you're black and just how black you are, if there are degrees?
I think what I've learned is that I do. And I, you know, other people are always going to have their opinions. You cannot control what other people think, but you can control like what you do and what you do with your emotions. So for me, I've kind of like decided like I'm not going to let that part of me be beholden to someone else, whether it's my blackness, my queerness, like anything about me. But I know that those are always going to be competing forces happening.
In the end, I don't want to spoil the movie, but there, a DNA test ends up being like mm-hmm. this ultimate place where you turn. And there's a recurring image of a black card as in like a credit card that says the black card. And this is what you're trying to get. And ultimately, you decide that a DNA test is probably the best way for you to get that. But why did you want to get your DNA tested? Did that feel like it would give you objective proof that you are Black? Like, is that what you were actually searching for when you did that?
When I did that, I just wanted to know more about my family history, because I think for a lot of Black people in America, and also a lot of people in America, your ancestry only goes back so far, so you don't really know where you came from or where your people came from. So I was curious, like, how could science tell me more about where I came from and more of my story? And at the time, 23andMe was letting Black people do DNA tests for free. So I was like, all right, I'm in. And then I got the results, and I was really nervous. But when I got them, and I was like, oh, okay, I feel better now. And actually, the same company is sponsoring a Mixed Remix Film Festival that I'll be in L.A., all about mixed race people, because I think for a lot of people, in America, they're like, well, you know, maybe I'm English, maybe I'm British, maybe I'm Nigerian, but this can kind of give you an idea of like where you could have come from.
The percentages. So you were, was it more than 50% African?
Yeah, and that was the part that I was like, yes. I think a lot of people are doing that, and you don't always get back what you think you will. And in some ways, that's good. Like, you can realize that you're part of this big world and you have a mixture of a lot of things. But also, I can't let that tell me if I'm Black enough either. Like, ultimately, it's up to me. And like, my science is one thing, but like, just like your genitals don't define your sexual identity. Like, that doesn't necessarily mean that, yes, you have passed this mark. Although when I got it, I was really happy. But I think even if it had been like 48%, I'd still be like, no, I'm still Black.
I mean, did you actually feel different inside when you had that information that came from taking saliva and sending it to some people and getting back like analytics on that?
I did. I felt happy. I felt a bit of relief. And I had to preface that by not saying that I think one people is better than other people, but it just fit the me that I had, and I was happy to see that. And I was also curious, because I at that point I had never been to the continent of Africa, so I was curious like where my people would have come from, and like with the slave trade, like did we come from the West parts like most people did. And I was fortunate enough to go to Tanzania last year, and I was talking with our, we did Airbnb there, and I was talking to our host, and he was like, oh, well, you know, you could have come from East Africa. And I'm like, yeah, I don't think so. But even he, when he was saying he would go visit Sudan, and he's like, whoa, those people are Black. And, you know, I'm not even that Black. And I'm like, you live in Tanzania. You're from Tanzania. Like, how can you not be Black? Like, it was funny to hear him also talk about that.
Let's hear from Amber about what it means to be Black enough. Hi, Amber.
Hi. My name's Amber. I'm 30 years old, and I've grown up in the Kansas City area. I'm a biracial woman, so I'm half Black, half white. So this is something that has constantly plagued me. Just kind of my two cents on the matter. I've grown up in predominantly white communities, and oftentimes the question of being Black enough has been centered through the lens of white people. Not very often do I hear other Black people tell me that I speak too white or listen to white music. It's often white people that tell me those things. So I just think that's kind of interesting. I feel like I've been readily accepted by the Black community, despite my white upbringing. So I just think it's interesting who gets to determine or ask about what it means to be Black.
Amber, can you tell me more about the tone that people are using when white people are questioning your Blackness? Like, how does that come up? And I don't know, like, what's the sort of attitude that comes with that questioning?
Almost congratulatory, like, you're not like the Black people I know. You're different, you know, you're into a different ideas than I'm accustomed to perceiving that Black people are into. And it's like, you know, you're not one of them type of deal. So that's kind of the experience I get from it. It's a positive thing for white people that they can feel like they align with me in some way, I think.
Carrie, does that sound at all familiar to you, or did you have just a totally different experience?
Oh, no, that definitely sounds familiar. I just concentrated the film more on the conversation with mostly with Black people, but I definitely got that growing up, like, oh, well, you know, you're different than the other ones, or like, you're more like this. And I think they definitely found comfort in it, but it made me more uncomfortable, and I took it kind of as an insult, like, oh, if I'm not like other Black people, then what in your mind are other Black people like? Like, if I'm your friend, why wouldn't you be their friend? Yeah, it made me feel uneasy.
Amber, how has that made you feel?
Uneasy as well. I've tried to impress upon white people who do make those kind of sentiments that Black culture is not monolithic, that there's not one idea of what it means to be a Black person, so they shouldn't assign these kind of arbitrary values. So, I mean, I also agree with her. It's not something I enjoy hearing by any means. It discredits a whole half of my being, so...
Well, Amber, thank you so much for sharing your story.
Okay, thank you.
And Carrie, I want to move on to one of our other callers, but you do have this sort of intersecting search for identity that has to do, in the movie, mostly with race, but also in the way you describe the movie, a little bit with gender, too. I mean, you describe yourself as a queer oddball. Can you talk a little bit more about how these two senses of belonging and identity intersect?
Yeah, well, if you bring up intersect, then I also think of intersectionality, Kimberly Crenshaw's term that she coined, where basically, like, you're not just a Black person or a queer person or identify as genderqueer, a genderqueer person. You're all of those things at once. So I can't really take out those parts of my identity and treat them one by one. So like when I joined the Black group at Barnard, like the head of it was a lesbian, and like she got a lot of flack from people for being a lesbian, and you know, you're a Black lesbian, like this is a thing that white people do. Or as I'm meeting a few more genderqueer people, like I think that's another layer of my identity that people are dealing with at the same time that I'm also dealing with. So it's, for me, they're all together. Like, I can never just be a Black person and separately a queer person. I'm a Black queer person. And there's identities with that. And then, you know, then there's like, oh, are you queer enough? And like, I don't know. There's all these levels that you have to contend with.
Let's talk to Teresa. Teresa has a question or maybe a story for us. Hi, Teresa.
Hey, Gina. This is one of the better shows I think you've had in the last year. I'm listening to it in my car, and I'm not even going to go home until your guest is great. Thank you so much. I totally agree with what Amber's saying, and I'm empathetic to that. I'm a white woman. But I guess I wonder why, and I think this is maybe white society that makes people do this, but why do you have to say you're one or the other? Like Barack Obama, I'm going to use him as an example, or Halle Berry, one white parent, one Black parent, but they both identify as Black, which is their total option. But why do they have to say that? What makes people feel like they have to say one or the other? That's really my question.
I think that's an interesting question. Also, when thinking about the history of race in America, and like racism and segregation, a lot of times there is like this one drop rule. So if you were even a part Black, then you were not, you know, admitted to this part of the society. You're not allowed to sit in the front of the bus. You could be a slave. You could, like, all these things happen because you were not 100% white in someone's eyes. Or like in my grandfather's case, when he wanted to buy some property in Michigan, like he was able to buy it as a white man. It was easier, and I don't know if he would have been able to buy it as a Black man. So for him, he had to make a choice. Sometimes he was actually had the option, like he could pick one or the other depending. But for a lot of people, they don't have that option. And because of how people are classified, like you're forced to choose. And if they see any hint that you might have African ancestry, that's it. You're just Black. But I'm really excited to go to this mixed festival in LA because, as I was talking to, I think, one of your producers, like when you're a mix of Black and white people, a lot of people just say like, oh, well, I'm Black, and they see you're part Black and that's it. But say you're a mix of Japanese and Nigerian or Indian and Persian. Like, those are two very strong cultures that, like, one of them doesn't necessarily cancel each other out. And I don't think my blackness also cancels out my European ancestry. But in those cases, unlike the one drop rule in America, I think people are like, oh, well, yeah, you can't just be Japanese if you're also Japanese and Persian. You're both of those things. But I think in America, we've kind of been forced into that way. And I'm also very happy to be black. So I don't know. It's I think in this country, it's very particular with that racial mixture.
Let's hear from Donna in Kansas City. Donna is of a different generation. And I'm curious, Donna, how you think your experience is similar or different from Carrie's, being of a different generation?
Some of us very similar, because I was raised in Pittsburgh, Kansas, which is very few black people live there. And I was the only black in my class until I was in the sixth grade.
How old are you, Donna? Do you mind sharing that with us?
I don't mind. I'm very proud of it. I'll be 72 years old this month. So when I graduated from high school, I don't remember the total number of students in our class, but, you know, maybe there was 200. In that, there was five black people, and one of them was my cousin. So that was the way that I was raised, although we did not necessarily socialize with the white kids. When I got out of college and I came to Kansas City, I was telling your producers that I would pass on the telephone because I'm a very dark-skinned black person. But I could, if I was trying to get an apartment, well, they would not rent to black people. And so I would call and make an appointment on the phone. I wouldn't just, if they had a sign in the yard, you know, saying it's for rent or whatever, we wouldn't do that. I'd call on the phone because I knew that on the phone they thought I was white. And then when I get there, they would be shocked. And, of course, they said it was already rented and I wouldn't get it. But it became kind of a game, I guess you might say.
You had to operate in a way where you had, I don't know, like, as far as this question about how black a person is, that the answer was different depending on whether it was based on seeing you or hearing you for other people.
For other people, but also in the workplace, I had never been around a lot of black people. And because I didn't sound like black people in Kansas City, I felt like the black people were a little leery of me. Because they thought maybe because I sounded so-called white. And also because I'd interacted with white people all my life. See, my cousin, who was raised in Kansas City, had gone to black schools all her life. She had a really difficult time when she came down to Pittsburgh to go to school because that was the most that she'd ever been around a lot of white people. So when I came to Kansas City, I think black people were kind of skeptical of me. And then white people just, you know, they just kind of keep their distance anyway, just because you're black. So it's just kind of an odd place to be in.
Yeah, you know, Carrie, there's something that kind of keeps coming up again and again, which is that so much of this depends on exactly where you are and when. If you go from, you know, one school to another or one town to another, everything can change.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's like people, they're not fixed. Even people at different points aren't fixed. So each place has its own culture in a way. Like there's the Mass culture, then there's, you know, American culture, then Missouri culture and Kansas City culture. And it's like, oh, there's culture on 18th and Vine versus culture in Ward Parkway. Like it's just every situation is different. And it kind of, by putting yourself in a certain situation, like you become part of that culture, and how people treat you and how you react is also tainted by that culture. Tainted or, you know, benefit sometimes.
Carrie Hawk's film, Black Enough, with an asterisk, has been making its way around the country. You can see it this Friday at the Kemper Museum of Contemporary Art. More information about the screening can be found on the Kemper's website. To listen back to this encore presentation or any favorite shows you've heard on Central Standard, just go to kcur.org/centralstandard. Sign up for our podcast while you're there and stay current on our news by following us on Twitter. We are at @KCURCST. KCUR's Central Standard is produced by Matthew Long Middleton, Sylvia Maria Gross, Jen Chen, Andrea Tudhope, and Suzanne Hogan, with help from intern Tom Taylor. I'm Gina Kaufman. Up to Date is next. Don't miss it.